Welcome, everyone. Thanks for being with me this next hour. You are listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks, asking the question, why wait for heaven? On 1-2 Radio, changing the way we experience life and spirituality. Today is January 9th, 2015. Welcome to the new year. On today's show, I'm happy to welcome back writer, graphic artist, and ACIM teacher Bruce Rawls. And on today's show, our theme is Make This Year Different by Making It All the Same. And that's one of the things that you'll find in the course, or you'll hear some of the course students talking about. So we're going to dive right into that, and I hope it'll be very provocative. And for those of you really considering studying the course this year or doing those workbook lessons, that's what I'm really going to hammer home here in January. I just really want to excite you about the possibility of really making your life different by making it the same, by really being a part of A Course in Miracles. So thanks for being here today. And if you'd like to join us in the 12radio.com private group on Facebook, you can do that by going to the 12radio.com website. And on the left side of the page, just click that chat button and you'll be automatically redirected to our private group. And that guy at the door that's ready to let you in, that's our producer, Scott Weaver. So Scott, thank you for being here today too. So without any further ado, let's get Bruce on the line. Welcome, Bruce.
Thank you, CA, for having me again.
Yes, very much. And I'm hoping you're having a great new year.
So far, so great.
Yep. Oh, good. I'm glad to hear it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm excited very much about 2015. And of course, I'm always excited about the new year. It always feels like the opportunity to turn over a new leaf. And more than any other time of year, it feels like we can wipe the slate clean and really start over. So I'm excited about some of the things that we'll be doing this year. And I want to thank you, too, for all of your great suggestions for today's show. I mean, when I asked Bruce what he wanted to talk about, he just came back with more. I mean, it would take me about 15 minutes to read all this. And so it's wonderful stuff. So, Bruce, thank you very much for suggesting today's theme. And I'm just going to follow your lead. I'm going to let you dive right into what does it mean to keep everything the same and make it different at the same time.
Well, that's actually taken from the course, and there's a quote in the course that says, make this year different by making it all the same. And the idea behind that is that if we can look at all of the things that we made up, all of the illusions as being equal and identical, in other words, illusion A equals illusion B equals illusion C, that basically allows us to zoom back out from our identification with the personal self that we think we are, that ego wants to convince us we are. And we've done a bang up job of I was thinking about the Academy Awards coming up in a month of three or whatever. And you know, the awards given out for, you know, best actor and actress and everything. And I'm thinking, you know, no matter if you stacked up, you know, how many decades of Academy Awards and all that kind of stuff, it doesn't hold a candle to the acting performance that we've all given ourselves in convincing ourselves that this is the real deal. This space-time dream drama world is reality. I mean, we think this is it. And it'd be silly to not acknowledge it and behave in a normal way.
Yeah.
but if we can step back and just remember that what A Course in Miracles is really trying to get our attention, you know, when it says these, since you mentioned provocative, you know, the provocative phrases, and they're like, there is no world. This is the central idea, the concept the Course attempts to teach. Well, I mean, that's kind of a tough one, but I think we can begin to undo our suffering and our misery by looking at every time we reinvest in making things different, by making things a big deal out of what appears to be preferences that we like, that we go beyond mere preferences and make them important. And
right,
make
special.
Exactly. Things happening or not happening, you know, certain way, people behaving or not behaving in a certain way, including ourselves, and all the different specifics of our lives that I'm, like I said, it'd be silly to not do what we can to make this world as enjoyable and peaceful and helpful to everyone as possible. But if we get hung up in thinking that what is out on the screen of our mind projected out onto this world is going to make us happy. You know, we're getting the cart before the horse instead of the heart before the course.
Yeah.
and we're turning it upside down. And I think that's what A Course in Miracles attempts to do, is to uninvert the inversion that the ego has made, that this fake self that we've adopted and made this stellar acting performance so thoroughly, and we're so, you know, taken into our roles. We're so much in character that we don't even know that it's a character.
Absolutely.
we forget that, you know, the puppet, the theatrical expression is subject to our mind's choice. And really the only choice we ultimately have is the choice of teachers. And the teacher that leads us away from the tragedy and the euphoric, it's not really true comedy. It's really the temporary gain at someone else's expense, including our own, in the world, is when we make things different. And I think that's why that's such a profound and far-reaching idea in the course, is to make things the same, is really to generalize and to look at how we can take what seems to be different things in our life and look at the stories and the lessons that we learn and put them together and realize, there's a common thread here. I think I was drawn to mathematics early, and particularly geometry, at an early age, because you could say, well, gee, I can walk over to this corner of the room and the laws of mathematics are the same. You know, 3 + 7 is still 10. You know, if I go down the hall or out the door or to a different planet or galaxy, I mean, that's kind of cool. So I kept thinking, well, what's universal? And I think looking for what doesn't change, what's universal, what doesn't depend on who you are, where you are, you know, all the particulars of time and space. So mathematics is kind of a nice metaphor, but the deeper understanding is really not something is the great theory that sometimes we use once in a while we grab a calculator, but if we can look at our identity and what we're invested in and what we you know, like Ken Wapnick says, is you know, if you stagger to the bathroom mirror every morning and you still think you see a reflection that you identify with, and it's not, obviously you wouldn't try to not see the reflection, but if you, the more that we identify with that that character, the more we're making it different. We're making what appears to be separate identities important. And I think that the way we can kind of ramp that down a little bit and make it on a more practical level is to look at every time we want to make grievances or issues that we have with each other a big deal, that's when we're making differences important. And differences aren't the same.
That's right.
So we're not making it all the same. When we see not eye to eye, when we don't share the interests with other people, when we say, oh, there's somebody that I live with or that I work with or that I see on TV or read about or you know, watch a clip on the web about, or, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, how it crosses our mind. If there's something that's fed back to us from our sensory data and we make a big deal out of it, we're saying that the difference is important, and that our peace, we're willing to compromise our peace in that moment for something of fleeting value, of fleeting importance. But we're investing it every time that we do. And so I think that's where there's a set of laws that was in a book called The Kabbalion, that was the law of gender or generation was the last of those seven laws, the first being mentalism. So they kind of wrap around and sort of bookmarks there. But generation, if you think about how our mind in ego mode likes to fragment out and divide and subdivide and subdivide, and, you know, and if we think of what the course's metaphysics and the mythology, if you will, of A Course in Miracles suggests, is that the ego being terrified that it somehow had fragmented perfect oneness, basically trying to hide from the unconscious guilt of that, made up a totally dysfunctional but totally consistent plan to keep our mind hidden. And by doing so, it made up it made up this vast cosmic realm of space and time and you know, countless objects. I mean, just even in one cell in our body, there are countless atoms and molecules. And then if you think of the fractality and the fact that the Big Bang theory says we just keep dividing, and you know, all the separate galaxies and planets and, you know, solar systems and planets and creatures of all shapes, sizes, and colors and yada yada, and it just keeps going and going on and on and on. But if we look at that with a gentle smile and say, oh, we made that up in order to keep us distracted, and we can mindfully turn it around and use this generative ability to generalize instead of generating, you know, making is what the course jargon is we, the ego makes and spirit creates. So, but creation is one. If we generalize and bring things back together, pulling in the parts. In the Egyptian mythology, Egyptian pantheon, Isis, who was the wife of Osiris, who was basically split apart in all these pieces, pulls Osiris's pieces back together, and you know, reconstitutes him basically. So, but that's
right.
That's kind of like what I think. What we're doing is whenever we recognize a fearful emotion or an attitude or something that annoys us, whether it's, you know, a hangnail or a holocaust in our world, and recognize that we've projected that out. We've split apart, like the crocodile god Sobek, you know, represents in the Egyptian pantheon. We've blasted apart the Big Bang of ego strategy is to separate, to pull apart, to make things different so that we can then stand back as with consciousness, which of course is an ego concept, because it always has a subject and an object. So once we say, oh, I'm looking at this other thing, that otherness is really can be undone by simply looking at and then bringing back inside and saying, oh, this is a projection that I need to forgive. I need to forgive myself ontologically by pulling back in, saying whatever it is that I'm feeling a discomfort around, or the least little a bit of discouragement or depression or anxiety or anger, whatever it happens to be, any negative emotion, pull it back inside and say, this is something that I made up, and I can bring it back inside with that inner guidance, that inner kindness teacher, if we will, and then recognize that that gives us the ability to reintegrate, to reunify, and recognize that ideas didn't leave their source. We really haven't gone away from that perfect creative spirit, and every time we forgive ourselves, we're bringing those pieces back together, and it's a holographic thing because in truth, and I think that's where science is can be helpful when we look at things that are fractals and holograms and things that have that quality where each little part resembles the whole.
Mm-hmm.
It's an indicator or a symbolic reminder that we can pull it back inside. We can see that there's the sameness to each of the seemingly separate parts, no matter where they are, or how far we zoom in or out. I mean, there's that sameness of quality that we have to look past the form, though, to the content in the mind, and see, you know, for example, that a quote that I think is Ian McKellen that was attributed variously to Plato and Philo. You know, the be kind for everyone is fighting a hard battle.
Yes.
And I think if we do that, we see we're all fighting, we're on the same boat. We're all fighting the same battle of trying to undo, ironically, this egoic self that we made up that exists only in a dream, only in a fearful, nightmarish dream that doesn't have any basis in reality, in the true reality that we never left.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, but that's just a little a little bit of commentary on how we can make things all the same. Do you have any other comments about that?
Yeah, actually, there's been a couple of things that have been running through my mind, and certainly one of them is, because I'm an expert at this, you know, we love to make things complicated, and that's what I was thinking, like, for instance, when we feel irritated, when we feel frustrated or angry or anything, bringing it back in and just saying, I don't like to feel this way, because what I want to do is I want to analyze and go, okay, why did I do this? Why do I need to do this? And all of a sudden, I'm right back in my mind, and I'm right back into that separation thing and making my lists of why this was justified or why it wasn't justified. And it's sort of like, no, you don't even have to go there. You don't have to keep making it complicated. All you have to really do is say, you know what? I'm feeling uncomfortable and I don't like this feeling. And there's another way to feel about this. And that's really difficult for me, but I'm really trying to rein in all of the over-analysis because of I like it. I like to separate all the things out and classify all the little things. But just recognizing more and more that I'm doing that, you know, because I like it. That's it. You know, I mean, I think that's one thing that people sometimes will get to is that we like feeling frustrated or angry because it really serves that purpose of keeping us feeling separated. And if overall that's our purpose is to feel separated, to feel right, to feel justified, then it doesn't matter the face. We can forgive one person and just move right on to the next one. We will create another character in our, you know, Oscar winning performance that's going to be the adversary.
Exactly. And as you're saying that, I was thinking too, it's also important to remember that it doesn't necessarily mean that we have to bring that up to other people to tell them that, their mind is really, filled with their own choices. All we really do is remind ourselves when we catch ourselves feeling the least bit deprived or put upon or miserable in any way, especially if we think of it's at someone else's expense, then we're at the bottom rung of the ladder, as Kevin would say, of the victimhood. But I think we need to do that gently. I mean, and to just to because it is easy to become indignant and outraged when we're confronted with the idea that we made this up, and it's of our own choosing, and it's purposive. And I think that's one of the things that Ken brilliantly points out, and Ken Wapnick in his work, is that in addition to the mystical traditions of the East that describe the universe as an illusion, and modern physics as well, there's this other element in the A Course in Miracles that is just brilliant, that says, this is purposive. Our resistance and our fighting, tooth and nail, to be, fighting against being mindfulness is really ego strategy to keep us in a state of suffering, to keep us in a state where we don't experience the peace that is not contingent on any specific time or place or situation or circumstance. And
and in fact, I love that concept. When Ken says it a lot, and I love just that idea of being on purpose, because I think we like to think that those are distractions or those are detours that happen to us. And he just keeps bringing it back and saying, no, every single one of these behaviors or attitudes is on purpose. It serves function. And it really does kind of stop you in your tracks. Because in fact, I was talking to somebody the other day who is feeling very depressed about a job situation, not having a job that he really enjoys. And he made a few comments, when I asked him, when I delved into it a little bit, he did report that every time he gets a job, he really does not like the people he works with. And of course, what I wanted to point out is, well, it sounds like the common denominator is you, but I did not do that. I was trying to be kind. But what did strike me is, as I was talking to him and talking about, well, what are the different kinds of things that you like to do? And, is it maybe that you really need to go into a different line of work with a different kind of people? He said to me four or five times, I've tried everything. And so finally, I just said, really? You've tried every single thing on the planet? Every single thing? There's not one more thing you could try? Because, I mean, I was kind of at a loss as to how to even support him. Because If you've tried everything and absolutely nothing works, then I don't know what I can say. And, you know, I know he didn't like me being a little confrontive like that, but I thought, really? Every single thing, there's not one single strategy you can try.
Somehow that reminds me of the, you know, which could be a course platitude if thrown back in someone's face, but something to remind ourselves when we catch ourselves, you know, trying to foist it onto some external person or thing. You know, of all the causes of your suffering, your guilt was not among them, you know. You know, but that's it. I mean, that's the last place we're ever going to look. But fortunately, the last place is really where, when we do look, we begin to systematically generalize and undo that unconscious guilt by forgiving ourselves moment to moment to moment. When we catch ourselves, you know, making big deals out of stuff and throwing our, you know, practicing our tantrum yoga, so to speak, you know,
yeah.
by making a fuss about wanting things in the dream of our life to be a certain way. So I think that mindfulness really is contingent on remembering that this is a colossal dream, a colossal holographic projection. And we're watching, you know, a puppet show. We're watching a theatrical production of vast proportions, but it's a production.
Yes. And would you say that comment again and tell us if you know where it is about the guilt was not among it? Would you say that again?
I'd have to Google it, but I somewhere in the course it says, of all the causes of your suffering, and I'm paraphrasing here.
Yes.
Your guilt was not among them.
Yeah. I love that. I love it. And I guess I could too. I mean, I've got an electronic version. I could put those words in and it would find it for me. But I love that. And I mean, to me, that's also hilarious. It's very, very funny because, yeah, you look at everybody else and everything else before ever just looking inside.
Right.
So anyway, go ahead. I interrupted you, but I was so stuck on that. I love that phrase.
That's a great one. And really, that's such an important one to remember. Whenever we feel this, the least little bit of upset, is that's really what we're undoing. We're undoing unconscious but unfounded guilt, and that's, I think, a really helpful idea that it's unfounded. Whenever the beauty of our lives, the way we've set it up, and not the way we've set it up, but the way the Holy Spirit, aka our inner kindness teacher, aka Jesus in the Course, helps us undo that is by looking at. You don't have to necessarily change anything behaviorally, although sometimes it will result in behavioral changes. But the only really real requirement is that we just look with that inner kindness teacher, with that principle that we brought with us into the dream that is our way out. It's our breadcrumbs or the string we took into the cave that we can, you know, blindly but consistently keep gently pulling that string, finding out our way back out into the light, and that's by looking at each thing that happens to us and saying, oh, I made this up, I own it, number one, and number two, it didn't happen in truth. Anything that can change is not true. Anything that has an ebb and flow or a fluctuation couldn't possibly be true because truth is unchangeable. How could anything that changes be true? But if we look at that and recognize that anything that's happening to us that is not going to be around in you know, a second or a year or a millennia, I mean, even even the cosmos itself, you know, we're told in a few billions or maybe trillions of years, and who knows when they'll up the estimate, will be just this blob of heat bouncing around.
So no more astrologers, huh?
Yeah. I'm afraid that your days are numbered, but so are mine and everyone else's. But I wouldn't worry too much because that's, you know, some billions of years out there. But anyway, but that's such an important, I think, and helpful idea that if we see that the guilt that ego is terrified of looking at is unfounded, then we can afford to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's only if this is this booga booga scary thing, you know, this horror film, and obviously ego is going to pull out all the stops to keep us from looking at it and make it as this terrifying experience, and make it a dark night of the soul kind of thing. But there's throughout any of those experiences, if you really look at it and are honest with yourself, you realize, yeah, this too shall pass, as they say. And it's just part of the show. It's part of the special effects of this dramatic production that the ego is putting on. And it eventually will be over.
Yeah. Now, I have a question, and this is the kind of question I shouldn't be asking you, but I'm going to anyway, you know? And so when I ask Susan these kind of questions, she's like, I'll see you. But, you know, it's just that idea. Do you think there are people, I guess I would say... No, there are no people. No, do you think that there are people literally walking among us who totally get this?
I suspect there are.
I
bet that they're probably far and few between, and... You know, I would suspect people like Ken Wapnick may have been one of them. For example. But I don't think I think that's kind of a distraction.
It is. Well, Bruce, like I said, I'm an expert distractor. That's what I'm good at.
I'm not to say there's anything wrong with that. I'm just saying that may not be in our best interest to become, you know, fixated.
Focus.
On it.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to let that
but
one
if
go.
But if you find people that you really admire that you feel incredibly peaceful and comfortable with in that regard, usually it's because they have begun in some capacity to apply this you know the guidance of our inner kindness teacher, and I think that's you know, something we can emulate but make it our own and take the things that we find inspiring and you know, put it on our own words and find our own unique way of expressing it without making the uniqueness a big deal.
That's right. Without making them different.
Exactly. Exactly. That's why when I started hearing myself going down that road, you gotta remember that the whole purpose of it has to be ultimately to undo the belief in separation. And that's really the only way we get home. And that's the only counsel that our inner kindness teacher gives us.
And yet,
ultimately. And but it yet, takes spirit forms, yeah.
Yeah, and what I was going to say, and yet it's the hardest thing to do. And yet I'm not sure it's a hard thing to do. It's just something we have to do on a consistent basis.
Right.
You know, just always, like you say, go to the inner kindness teacher. Just be consistent about challenging every time we come up with something. Oh, this is different. This is special. This, you know, I am a victim in this situation. I have a right to feel this way. You know, just challenging it at every single moment. Because in some ways it's not difficult. It's just you have to be consistent, right. Which I don't think is a human quality.
Well, that's good. Well, in a sense, it isn't. I mean, consistency is really, in the Manual for Teachers of A Course in Miracles, it says that honesty is really consistency, is one of the 10 characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
And the consistency is like you say, it's sort of superhuman because, but that's what we're all being asked to grow out of is the childishness of thinking that we are just these individual personas. I mean, and it's ultimately an arrogant assumption on our parts. Not the one to beat ourselves up about, though. We can when we look at it, and when we, for example, when we find ourselves arguing with people that we live with or work with, or you know, yelling at the TV,
uh-huh.
stuff that, or the web or whatever, or in anything that pushes our buttons, if we can catch ourselves and not try to, you know, nuke the ego, not try to dismantle it or blow it up or you know, throw a bucket of water on it, you know, and have it melt like the Wicked Witch or anything.
Right.
Because it's not going to go away. The ego is not, as long as we're here in this world, it's going to be there. It's going to be a full-blown 100% thought system. But what we can do is we can turn down in our mind, in our decision-making mind, we can turn down the soundtrack. Because it's like there's two different audio tracks. It's a stereo. Our mind is sort of like a stereo receiver. We've got our inner kindness teacher's track, and we've got the ego's track. And it's sort of like a pan pod, is a term that, you know, audio engineers might be familiar with. It's basically allows you to fade one out while you're fading the other in. And I think we do that all the time. Moment to moment. It's actually probably more of a binary switch that we toggle really fast at times, but
right.
but you know, if we average it out, it probably can seem like we're just sort of fading in and out. But when we look at our choice of thoughts, whether they're inclusive or exclusive, whether they're ones that incorporate shared interests, or it's the default ego, me first, you know, what's in it for me, then we can see the difference. And I think that the course uses differences in order to see that our thought system based on differences is dysfunctional. So there's the irony there, right?
Right.
A Course in Miracles is a purely non-dualistic teaching, but it's expressed in ways that appear to be dualistic because, as Ken Wapnick says, and I've just started reading The Journey Through the Text, which is wonderful. Our local study group here in Castle Rock, Colorado is doing that. It reaches us where we think we're at. So the form that it takes oftentimes uses metaphors like God weeps at our mm-hmm. Our absence, that kind of thing. Obviously, they would imply tear ducts and physiology.
Right.
And I don't think that's the metaphysics that's being postulated. But we relate to those because we think we're bodies. So as long as we think we're here, we need to use the experiences of our everyday lives as our classroom, and use it to undo the prison that the ego made. But brick by brick, every time we choose against the ego, or we not beat ourselves up, maybe just a little less longer.
Right.
when we indulge in an outburst of anger or whatever kind of upset seems to cross our mind, if we can just say, oh, well, this time I cut it off at 3 days instead of 4 days of ranting and raving about this whatever's going on in my life, or whatever seems to be, right? But that's progress. I mean, that's actually, if none of it happened, then it's almost like the times that we're in ego mode is like a gap in the recording, in truth.
Right. Right.
And I love that phrase early in the text where it says, all of your kindnesses and loving thoughts I've saved for you and purified them of their errors. All the beauty, truly, that we really are, not in form, but in content, in our mind, as one being, how could it have ever been lost? Not a note in heaven's song was missed. So we're each one of us seem to be a note, but we're really all the song. We're really all this perfect forgotten song that we never left. And that's what we're to remember.
Yeah. And that's beautiful. But you know what I was thinking? I love your analogy of the different track system in terms of what we're hearing. But part of me is like, okay, how do we turn down the ego? Because I also know either in the text or in the workbook or both, it says the ego always speaks first.
Right.
The ego's loud and it's na 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 na. It'll do anything to keep you from hearing something else. And so how do we turn it down? And yet what you just said is perfect, because about, limiting the amount of time that we indulge in something, because in fact, I have a story about several years ago. My sister, I have a lot of brothers and sisters, and we would get together and just really bitch about somebody else, what we were upset about, and this happened and that happened. And we were going to spend the weekend together. And I said, 30 minutes. We're going to talk about this for 30 minutes, and then I don't want to hear about it the rest of the weekend. I said, because I just can't do this all weekend long. And she said, okay. So it was like we gave ourselves 30 minutes to get out everything that we were frustrated or angry about, and then we had a great weekend. But it really taught me that, and I do that in my own life sometimes. It's sort of like, okay, I know that I'm just, on the pity pot. I know I'm just like feeling sorry for myself, but I'm going to do that for 1 hour, and then I'm going to move on. that's progress.
It is. Yeah, that's a great technique. And it reminds me of something I heard once where an indigenous Native American tradition was, when someone in the tribe has an issue, they can talk about it three times. They can bring it up three times in group conversations. And after that, everyone will turn their backs and not listen.
Yeah. I love that.
Isn't that cool?
I love it.
The idea, of course, the idea is not to get hung up on a ritual or a dogmatic form, but to just say, I can choose to limit this. And I think that's really the pivotal awareness that allows us to step back, watch the ego shenanigans, watch its dream drama, making a big deal out of stuff, and that inner smile that doesn't have to necessarily be this, stupefied, dopey-looking facial expression if it's not appropriate. But that inner smile, though, can watch even while we're in the midst of our you know, tantrum yoga class. We can say, oh, yeah, I'm ranting and raving about this. But you know what? I can see the steam, you know, fading. I can see it waning. And you know, kind of like those, now that Christmas is over and you see all the, at least in the neighborhood I'm in, you know, a lot of the neighbors have these for their kids, these inflatable Santas and and snowmen and whatnot. And when you turn off the blower, they're just going
to... They just go to the ground.
Yeah. And I think that's sort of watching that point of awareness, that decision-making mind that we all have that can look at how silly it is to argue, as Richard Bach would say, argue for your limitations, and sure enough, they're yours. You know, well, they seem to be, right? but we can afford to laugh at it from that point above the chessboard, like the Cheshire Cat, you know, grinning down silently at the two sides, you know, the dualistic battlefield of the mind that the ego tries to, you know, passionately, diligently, violently to maintain. And yet it's all for show.
And I love that analogy too of the snowmen and the trees and everything. They just go to the ground when you let the air out. And in fact, when you said before about throwing the water on the Wicked Witch, even though you were saying don't do that, it's like, but I love that too, because we think it's something formidable. You know, we think it's something real, and all of a sudden we throw a bucket of water on it and it disappears. It's like it wasn't what you thought it was at all.
Right.
You know, it just like, poof, it's gone.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I think the point of the comment I made earlier was if we think that doing something in form is going to, in the realm of effect, is going to change the cause in our mind, then we're just kidding ourselves.
Right.
But if there are things that we do, which the Course would call magic thoughts, whether it's, you know, taking vitamins or medicine or maintaining a health regimen or, you know, in my case, say slowly backing off on the holiday sweets, you know, just because you don't want to, you know, obviously go into shock if you drop them suddenly, right?
That's right.
you might get the nutritional equivalent of the bends or something, right?
So right, exactly.
Decompression, right?
Like the way you think.
but if we could just kind of be gentle with ourselves and watch dispassionately and say, okay, I'm just going to wean myself slowly of this thought system, then it's you know, kind of like cooking a lobster. You know, it's just you turn up the heat slowly, and pretty soon this thing is cooked. If you plunge it into boiling water right at the outset, it's going to pop out, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. You know. Yeah, I like that. But that's it. You know, it's we're so used to that belief system. That's our go-to belief system.
Yes.
And it's hard. I mean, habits are there for a reason. They're ingrained. And that's why we have to be so conscious that it is a habit and that it doesn't have to be that way.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
I mean, just that whole idea of, you know, we're wrong. You know, just admit you're wrong, and there might be another way to do this.
There exactly is. Yeah. I mean, that's totally so true. I know we've talked on previous conversations about some movie metaphors. One that comes to mind, as you said, that was The Truman Show. And I think that I would imagine a good percentage of your listeners have seen that movie with Jim Carrey. And, you know, it's all about assumptions. We assume that our life is the way we see it. But, you know, that in that particular movie, he discovers at the end that it's just been on he's been on a movie set his whole life.
Right.
You know, this is a theatrical production of the mind. And we can afford to laugh at it when we, you know, it's like, hey, you're on candid camera here. You know, it's like, whoops, you know, some of those I'm seeing a lot more on Facebook. People, you know, my Facebook friends are posting these, you know, hilarious gags where they have the hidden camera. And then they finally at the end, the shill, you know, person or persons will point out the camera, and then they have a good laugh over it. I think if we can remember to do that, and catch ourselves during the day and even in our dreams at night, for that matter, but recognize that it's the same thing. That's another
idea that we could go
to. That our nighttime dreams and our daytime dreams really are no different other than the form. They're both projections. They're both, basically our mind on ego's vomit, if you will.
Yeah, we are so incredibly creative.
Aren't we though? I mean, it's creative only in a perverse, bizarre sense, but it's not, like Ken says, it's not evil, it's not wicked, it's not sinful, it's just silly.
Right.
But if we look at what ego calls sin and put it on the table, bring it to the examination table or to the altar of our mind or whatever, and under the high intensity light, and pretty soon it's like, oh, it's vaporizing. There's nothing there.
That's right. It's just disappearing. I mean, the analogy I always love that helps me really understand why our daytime dreams are the same is that when I do have a dream at night and I wake up, I literally go, oh, that was just a dream. And I can easily believe, oh, I was just creating that all night long. Mm-hmm. That has no real basis in reality. And so if then I can apply that idea, make the same idea apply to the daytime dream, why can that not be, true as well? Mm-hmm. That someday I will wake up from this one and go, oh, boy, that was just a dream.
Exactly. And I think the transition between the daytime and nighttime dreams can be really helpful. One of the things I've been practicing for some time, and I usually remember nowadays, is as I'm falling asleep, I try to read something inspirational. In fact, lately it's been these which we may actually get to.
Yeah, I really want to hear about that website you sent to me.
Yeah, it's facimoutreach.org. And there's a list of over 1,000, I think there's like 1,300 or something like that, Q&As or questions and answers that the Foundation for A Course in Miracles has put together over the years. And they're all brilliant. I started at first for a number of years when I found out about them, just kind of reading a few at random here and there. And then the more I read, it's like, these are all brilliant and all very nicely done and really, speak to the heart of what the Course's thought system is addressing for us.
Wow. And,
so if you go to FACIM for Foundation of Course in Miracles, outreach.org, and click on the digital study guides. Let me bring up my web browser.
And I'll go ahead and I'll post that in the chat room too.
Yeah, it's basically if you click on. Actually, facim.org, you can click.
You can find it as well.
You can find it that way as well, yeah. But each of these, I'm on about 200 now going through, and it's probably going to take me a few more years reading two or three a day, but that's okay. But the ones that I read this morning that were I thought brilliant, maybe we'll have time to just read the first one. How's that sound?
Okay, that sounds good. And like you said, it's a group of people, like maybe Ken and a number of people who put these answers together.
Right. I think Ken led the effort, my understanding, but other staff members contributed as well. But they're just all brilliant. I mean, they're just wonderful. Oh, here it is. If you go to facim.org and click on online learning aids, which is the third from the bottom, one, two, three, four, five, six, seventh one down on the left-hand side on the website. It just says online learning aids. If you click on that, the first one that opens up as that expands is question and answer. And then it'll give you a link to facimoutreach.org. And from there, you can click on either the topic index if you want to search for a specific question, which is great because it lists a whole bunch of different topics that are all things that people ask questions about and want to know about. And then the list of all questions, which is the one that gives them all in chronological order, which is what I've been doing.
Boy, this could keep me busy for a very long time.
Oh, yeah. And so I'll just read the first one.
Okay.
The first one is question number 215. The first one, as I've been reading them. Uh-huh. But obviously, number one is the first. This one says, the Song of Prayer, page 6, says that praying for material things is not what prayer is. This is only a call for hiding our guilt and a call for our enemy, our own. Then is the correct way of praying a prayer of gratitude only? How do we deal with our internal desires? If our only goal is knowing God, how do I pray? Should I be in silence? Praying with others is then both looking to God. How do I deal with wishful thinking? And the answer that's provided here is, This beautiful scribe piece, The Song of Prayer, came in response to the way in which students of A Course in Miracles were using the Course. Many students thought that the Course was telling them to ask Jesus or the Holy Spirit to heal their bodies, fix things, solve problems in the world, and get them what they wanted. So Jesus teaches us in the Song of Prayer what true prayer is. And I'm going to quick aside here. My favorite line in that whole little booklet is, "The secret of true prayer is to forget the things you think you need."
Yeah.
That's my little one take-home phrase that I've committed to memory, which I think is so helpful and humbling and amusing at the same time. So anyway, I'll go back to the answer here. He tells us first that it is not wrong to ask for material things. And in fact, as long as we think we're individuals living in the world, we cannot avoid praying that way. Prayer, he says, is like a ladder that we are climbing. And as we make our way up, our prayer will take a different form because our needs will change. We will have less and less guilt as we practice forgiveness. And, quote, "without guilt, there is no scarcity. The sinless have no needs," unquote. Thus, at the top of the ladder, when we are advanced teachers of God, we will not experience lack of any kind. We will not perceive separation, and therefore our prayer will be just a song of gratitude. But that is at the top of the ladder. And that harkens back to what you were asking earlier in the conversation today of are there people walking the earth that are
yeah.
at the top of the ladder, so to speak,
metaphorically? Yeah.
Yeah, I suspect there are, but, they're not the type that are going to,
say anything.
Put out a shingle or necessarily get on Oprah.
That's right.
There aren't a lot of people who have been that have, certainly been moving us in that direction. So then there's two more paragraphs here. On the lower rungs of the ladder, we experience all kinds of needs and desires. That is normal. We need to be gentle about that and not deny them. If we are honest and we acknowledge that they are coming from a faulty perception of ourselves, we will not be held back by them. Asking for specifics is not wrong, and feeling guilty about the fact that we have needs and desires is never helpful, nor is fighting against them. We need only say, "This is where I am right now. And when I'm less fearful, I will allow more love to come in, and I will not experience lack or scarcity." Which, of course, usually we think that has to do with form, right?
Right.
It is so important to remember that this is not a course in sacrifice or asceticism. This is a slow process, a gentle one, and we do not jump from the bottom of the ladder right up to the top. There are many steps in between, and if we're doing the best we can wherever we are, nothing more is ever asked of us. How gentle is that, right?
Yeah, really.
As we practice forgiveness, the form of our prayer will change of itself. And then the last paragraph is, our prayer in the lower rungs is always to ourselves that we would ask the help of Jesus or the Holy Spirit to look gently and without judgment at our ego thoughts and to see our interest as shared with everyone else's. When we have, quote, enemies, unquote, we have already seen our interests as separate from and in conflict with others. That is when we need to ask for help to have our own minds be healed through forgiveness. You probably could boldface own minds.
Yes.
When our need to have an enemy is recognized and then healed, we will have advanced closer to our true state of oneness. And then praying with someone will simply be a joyous acknowledgement of our oneness as Christ and the oneness of Christ and God. Asking out of need will no longer have any meaning.
Nice. So. Oh, that is wonderful. And I think maybe at one time I was aware these questions were on that website, but it's completely escaped my mind. And I'm so excited to be introduced to this.
Well, there's just a lot in there, and I definitely recommend, certainly for, seasoned students of the course, and I think for people who are relatively new to that material, if they have specific questions and what they happen to be reading isn't doing it for them, go to the search function and search for, a keyword phrase or two that, addresses your question, whether it's something personal or something very specific. A lot of these are addressed and then brought back to that understanding that like Ken says, I've been listening to his, among many others, the one he did on sex and money. He says, well, I'm going to disappoint you because you think you're going to hear something about those specific things, but I'm going to eventually lead back to the core ideas.
Yes.
that really, it's all about changing the mind and changing any specific issue that we have, no matter what the form, back to remembering that it's all the same. It's all the same. True awareness that leads us back away from the specifics to what we never left.
Yeah, which is exactly what our topic is today.
Yeah.
Making this year different by making it all the same. And you're right, because I've got a lot of those, what I call those little books that Ken wrote.
Uh-huh.
And they all have, you know, some are on parents and children and sex and overeating and you name it. But it's all the same stuff again. Once
yep.
again, he's talking about separation. He's talking about the ego. Because it is. It's all the same. You know, the outside, what it looks like, we think it's going to be different. But it all goes back to the same belief system or the same worries or the same fears. It just goes right back every single time.
Yep. It gets back to that paraphrased quote of, you know, of all the many causes of your suffering, your guilt was not among them.
Yeah.
Because that beauty again is that it's unfounded. But only when we look at it. As long as there's a, you know, a scary monster under the bed and we don't turn the light on, then that monster is going to seem plenty scary. But,
yes.
But when we grow up enough to be willing to, at our own pace, and to realize that there's nothing out there that can get us or is out to get us, and there's nothing inside our mind either, that those inner and outer shields of oblivion are just strategies of the ego to keep us oblivious, to keep us mindless, and to further the dream rather than having us gently wake up from it.
Right. Well, and you know, what you just said is important, that there's nothing in us. And the reason I bring that up is I was just talking to somebody the other day, and we were talking about forgiveness, and she was kind of really focusing on a couple of people. And I said, but I want you to understand, it's important to really look at that, but really look at what it is, what is the real feeling behind it. I said, because, yeah, you can finally get to a place of peace with those two people, but if you don't come to peace with what the issue is, I said, you'll just recreate them. And she goes, well, that makes me feel depressed, because that means I'm always going to just keep recreating that because it's always there. And I said, actually, it's not. Mm-hmm. I said, it's just your belief that you need a person in your life to do that. I said, it's a script, and you can turn the script off, or you can rewrite the script. It doesn't, you know, you don't have to have a script that has punishment or, you know, some kind of harassment or whatever it is. You don't have to have that in the script. And then she kind of goes, oh, you know, oh, okay.
Now, that brings up some interesting points, because as we were talking about earlier, you know, if the commentary, and it's sort of like when you get a DVD and you go to the setup,
mm-hmm.
and in the setup, they sometimes have audio options for where you can actually listen to the director's commentary.
Yes.
Well, that's kind of like our life, you know, again, with those two audio tracks that we panned between or fade one up and fade one down. It's sort of like, but any given moment, really, it's a switch. We're just switching between the ego's director's cut commentary, which basically said, you should be outraged, you know, start your tantrum now.
Right.
You know, don't pay attention to these people that tell you that you know, you have a mind, you know, let alone that you can choose differently, you know. But that's what exactly, and it's really a silent track that has just this little Cheshire grin smiling at us of the Holy Spirit's, our inner kindness teacher's commentary is really, it's not so much in words, it's really just a feeling, I think, a lot of times, is that we get this little inner smile that comes over us when we step back far enough, this astronaut's perspective that zooms back out from our little, you know, personal soap opera drama enough to see that it's like, this is just part of a play. This is part of a stage production, and I can afford to look at this with a little wink and a nod.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and on that note, I'm realizing we do need to wrap up the show today, and I want to make sure I give you time to make any announcements. So is there anything going on, anything you want to direct our listeners to?
Oh, certainly. Yeah, I'm actually starting a new podcast series, and that'll be on ACIM blog. And there's all lots of other resources there. And I also have a Facebook page. Another thing, I'm hoping that they will extend the registration, but they're going to be doing lots of them, is the folks in Temecula at the Foundation for A Course in Miracles are starting to stream the video of their presentations. And I just signed up for the first one that's happening this weekend. I don't know if you can still sign up, but you might want to go to their website and find out. But in addition to being able to attend in person live, which I've only done once, for actually it was just a couple of half, you know, hour sessions, unlike some of my friends who've actually been out to Temecula and gone to the longer academy classes. Mm-hmm. But now they're streaming. So if you go to the facim.org website, you can and click on the Temecula schedule. It doesn't say streaming yet, but if you click on the Temecula schedule, you'll see that there are several different programs in the works, including one starting this weekend, that are going to be videotaped and streamed, and then you'll have a couple of weeks to watch them at your convenience. So.
Oh, so you don't necessarily participate right while it's going on?
Well, you can. I think that this first one, I'm not sure how many of the others are going to be interactive, but the first one and maybe several others aren't going to be interactive, but you'll be able to, you know, listen and watch the video of the presenters and the participants.
So, nice.
Isn't this great? So, yeah, I think this is wonderful because, I mean, there's a lot of times I would have liked to have gone to Temecula and attend these wonderful academy classes and then the shorter presentations, but now they're going to have them streaming.
Yay. So, well, thank you for that. That is wonderful news.
Isn't that great?
And I think Susan had mentioned that, but I wasn't aware that they were up and running. So thank you. And
yes.
When you come back to the show in February, I'd like to hear about that.
I'd
like to
will.
Hear what your experience was. So thank you for mentioning that. And Bruce, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
It's always wonderful. And I look forward to hearing what we'll talk about in February. And of course, maybe we need to talk about more movies for the Academy Awards, you know?
There you go.
That's always a lot of fun. So, well, thank you. And I look forward to that. And I also want to thank the listeners and everybody in the chat room today, and to our producer, Scott Weaver. And I want to remind you that you can always find me on Tuesdays on my other show, Simple Tales, at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 Eastern, where we do talk about astrology, part of the illusion in this world, but one of my favorite ones. And you can also find me for readings, personal consultations, mentoring, and coaching on whentolisten.com. Now, today, you've got about 5 minutes to get yourself a snack, a cup of coffee or tea or whatever it is, and be right back for The Through Line with Christine Dumaurier, coming up next on Fabulous Fridays on 1-2 Radio. Until next week, relax and wear loose clothes. You've been listening to A Course in Miracles with C.A. Brooks and my guest, Bruce Rawls, on 1-2 Radio, where we are changing the way you think about life and spirituality.